Welcome to the Expert Speak, a service of the Florida Psychiatric Society. I'm Abby Strauss, and thanks for listening.
For a long time, sleep was not properly understood, and because of that, it was thought to be more of a passive part of our existences. In truth, it's the opposite. It is as important to our existence as food and oxygen. Carl Sparazza is a family practitioner who has a special interest in sleep. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Abby.
Perhaps we can look at some of the problems specific to sleep deprivation, which apparently is becoming much more of a problem in our society. Let's start with a basic overall question. What is sleep? What do we know about sleep?
Once we thought it just played a passive role in our daily lives, sleep as we know it now is a very essential part of life. We know now that our brains are very active during sleep. The difference between coma and sleep is that during sleep you can be aroused, you can be awakened. During sleep, we have releases of growth hormone, which is essential for growth, tissue rejuvenation. We see alterations in blood pressure and pulse. At a time of good sleep, our heart rate goes down, our blood pressure goes down. It rejuvenates our system.
So it's like a whole nother series of events that are occurring when we're just looking very quiet and comfortable on the bed.
It is, and it's very complex.
Do we know enough about sleep so that we can better understand why it is so important? You begin to allude to it when you say it restores our bodies. Is it like the bank computers at night that do all the reconciliations and clean up all the stuff during the day? Is that kind of what it does?
Yes. It's like storing the events that you learned on that day to the right folders in your computer, your brain.
Is sleep the same for an infant as it is for a teenager, as it is for an adult, as it is for an older person? Does it change in the course of the years?
Absolutely. Newborns require up to 16 hours of sleep. As an adult, 7-8 hours of sleep. Teenage kids require 8 to 9 hours of sleep.
As a family practitioner, as the first line guy, what goes through your mind when someone comes to you and says, I can't sleep?
I try to explore the different aspects as to why. So I tell them we don't want to just put a Band-Aid on it. We want to explore why you can't sleep. Part of the history that we obtain is to make sure that they're not on any medications that could alter their sleep.
Such as, like, what would keep a person up?
Cold medications, decongestants, over-the-counter consumptions of caffeine in all forms, whether it's tea, soda, coffee, nicotine. Nicotine clearly affects the sleep.
It's like a nicotine withdrawal.
Exactly. It's theorized that's what wakes them up and they have to have a cigarette. And nicotine is considered a stimulant, so it does alter sleep patterns as well.
And of course, the big one that I have to ask right away is alcohol.
Alcohol is not conducive for good sleep. In a way, it can help you to fall asleep, but it disrupts your sleep patterns and you don't get the good restorative sleep like you should. So if you're going to consume alcohol, you want to do it earlier in the evening, not late at night before sleep.
What do we mean by a restorative sleep?
The objective measures that we look at is, are you waking up rested? Are you falling asleep during the day? Are you excessively tired during the day? Polysomnogram at night will monitor all aspects of sleep. So we look for certain brainwave patterns to make sure that they're getting the normal sequence of sleep patterns.
And those are the stage 1, 2, 3, 4, and then REM.
Correct.
Can you give us a brief outline of what these stages are all about? People hear them all the time, but I think most of us really don't understand the differences.
Stage 1 is considered the light sleep. We drift in and out of sleep. You could be easily awakened. It doesn't last long. It lasts for a few minutes. Sometimes you might see someone in that early stage 1 that they're very sensitive to awakening. So if they're starting to doze off, they might hear a noise and you see them jump. So that's typical of stage 1. Usually the PSG will show the brainwave conducive for stage 1. Stage 2 is a deeper type sleep. It has to do with the different electrical activities in the brain. The brain patterns become slower, but the result is leading into stage 3 and 4. Stage 3 and 4 is more your deep sleep. There's no eye movement or muscle activity. If they're awakened during the stage 3 and 4, they wake up tired. But stage 3 and 4 sleep is that deep sleep. And then the next cycle is REM sleep, rapid eye movement. You may get some muscle activity. During REM, our heart rate does go up. Blood pressure may rise.
That's when people dream.
Correct.
Do we need to go through all the stages every night to have the restorative sleep?
Yes.
Attached to this question is also the notion that a lot of times people are awakened in the middle of the night. Phone rings, someone comes in the house, the door slams, you have to go to the bathroom, all those types of things. How concerned are you with how many times they're getting up in the night for other things?
It's very concerning. It results in fragmented sleep. It disrupts that rhythm. Those sleep interruptions result in small bursts of cortisol production. And that's one of the first chemicals that's released upon normal awakening. These little awakenings at night, a spouse that snores, a dog that barks, it fragments our sleep.
One of the things that seems to be always a question is that sleep takes a tremendous amount of time in our lives. I mean, it's a chunk of time. It's like a third of our lives. So let's say that sleep is fragmented and you're not sleeping well. Is there a sense in the body that you have to catch up, that you need a certain number of hours? If you don't sleep well on Monday night, that Tuesday you're going to have to catch up or make up for the sleep that you didn't get on Monday night?
They call that sleep debt. A lot of people feel that they're going to catch up on that sleep on the weekend. They're used to not getting enough sleep during the work week and then trying to make up for their sleep on the weekends. That's actually disruptive to the circadian rhythm. It's hard to catch up on sleep. A short nap would be helpful. And of course, you have to limit your nap to 20 minutes. It doesn't take the place of a good night's sleep, but there are studies that show that 20-minute power nap can give you that extra energy to lessen that excessive somnolence during the day. It does not take the place of good 7-8 hours of sleep.
We live now in a society where so many people sleep at night with the TV sets on. And so there's always a little noise in the background, and there's light in the room. Is that good? Is it bad? Are we making it into a more dangerous thing than it really is?
Absolutely. In the evening, light of any sort, the brighter the light, the worse it is. It hinders the release of melatonin, which is a precursor to sleep. So roughly about an hour before you want to retire, you want to sleep, you want to avoid TV screens. You want to avoid the computer screen. You want to avoid the bright light. It does interfere with your ability to fall asleep.
People now wake up in the middle of the night, look at their iPhone, putting light into their eye. And are you saying that's enough to perhaps confuse the biochemistry and the rhythms?
Absolutely. Our third eye, so to say, is the pineal gland deep in the brain. And that is the regulator of melatonin. The brain requires darkness. With darkness, the pineal gland releases melatonin, and that's the precursor to sleep. At the same time, your cortisol levels are dropping into the evening. So when there's light or awakenings, whether it's spouse that snores, a dog that barks, you're getting small releases of cortisol that will initiate the awake response. We do have to be better about what we call our sleep hygiene.
It's very interesting because we may therefore be causing some sleep abnormalities or sleep deprivations, if we want to use that word, by our technology and our lifestyles. Maybe going back to living in a cabin was better when you blew out the candle and that was it, when you could sleep in a dark room.
That's how our bodies have responded for eons. Lately, with all the technology available, it is harder to get a good night's sleep.
Let's go back then to a patient who comes to you and basically has more or less a normal life. What do you, as a general physician, how do you approach it? What tests do you do? Just kind of walk us through maybe a generalized clinical evaluation.
The age is important. So, of course, you have to take the age into consideration. Part of the history would be medications, whether it's prescription or over-the-counter, if there's anything that they're consuming that could interfere with their sleep. Lab work-wise, you want to check and make sure that there's no thyroid conditions that could interfere with sleep. Environmental factors, we go over the bedroom. We go over what we call sleep hygiene, factors that are conducive for good sleep. Certain conditions, if someone has Alzheimer's or dementia, or if they've had brain trauma, brain injury, even certain cancers, those physiologically can interfere with sleep. Two other factors, and these are probably the most common, is stress and anxiety, the day-to-day life.
They carry that to bed?
Absolutely. If patient hasn't learned how to put that stress in a box and put it on their shelf and get it once he wakes up in the morning, he's going to have a hard time with sleep. So we do talk about stress management, coping skills. I give them a visual. Patients like visuals. So I suggest that they download their computer, their brain, to a piece of paper, write down their thoughts they would normally think about prior to bed, and put it on the nightstand. And that little simple piece of paper on the nightstand with those thoughts, in a way, clears their minds. So hopefully they could work on better night's sleep, knowing that that list is there when they awaken. And you as a psychiatrist, maybe you could share some thoughts in that regard too.
Well, we look at it in collaboration with you guys, because one of the things that we always have to worry about is not to be too quick to just assume that everything is just stress, that there can be a thyroid condition, it could be premenopausal or any other number of medical reasons. decisions that keep people up. And one of the things over the years is that all different levels of chronic pain can also be a nasty contributor. And it can be at relatively minor levels or on some really arthritic knee that's just waiting to be replaced. So this also has to become part of your workup as well. And we hope that you guys have worked up the patients and fixed as much as you can before they get to us.
It's an interesting point because without a good night's sleep, without that restorative sleep, pain thresholds are much lower. Once we get them in a better rest of sleep state, their pain thresholds are higher. That level 8 out of 10 pain the following day becomes more like a 6 or a 7. So for chronic pain management, we do focus on good sleep. There are other things too. Americans, we are not getting enough sleep, and it manifests in sleep deprivation. One other cause for not getting enough rest of sleep are conditions like obstructive sleep apnea.
Which is what?
Sleep apnea is when the brain is not getting enough oxygen at night. Typically, you see it in someone that's overweight.
And we have obesity problems, to say the least.
We sure do. The oxygenation in the blood typically is 99 to 100%. With severe sleep apnea, their levels could drop below 80%. So brain is not getting the oxygen that it needs at a time that it needs to be in a restless state. You're not getting into those deeper stages of sleep. You're getting shallow sleep so that you awaken so that you could breathe and get the oxygen that you need. At a time that your blood pressure and heart rate should be down, people with sleep apnea get elevations of their blood pressure and their heart rate.
Is that why we sometimes hear that people with sleep apnea are more prone to strokes and heart attacks and other cardiovascular problems?
Absolutely. TIAs, not unusual for them to have sudden death in their sleep as a result of stroke complications. Other manifestations of poor sleep or sleep deprivation, the hypertension, mental impairment, diabetes.
What about diabetes?
There's association of increased insulin resistance in patients that are not getting good sleep. In patients with obstructive sleep apnea, what we're finding is that they're more susceptible to diabetes mellitus. The NIH had a study and they curtailed sleep. So on normal healthy male subjects, they limited their sleep to 4 hours for 7 days. These are patients that had no predisposition to diabetes. They were healthy subjects. When they performed glucose tolerance testing on them after 7 days, testing showed impaired glucose tolerance compatible with that of a diabetic or pre-diabetic. And then the following week, when they were able to get their 7 to 8 hours of sleep, that glucose tolerance test went back to normal.
We don't think about that, at least outside perhaps of more of the internal medicine, family practice, or maybe endocrinology, but it's one more layer to the importance of getting someone to sleep properly.
Yes, and this is becoming especially true in our kids. In the children and adolescents, there's also an association with obesity. When we sleep, there's a balance of hormones. Ghrelin makes you feel hungry, and leptin gives you the sensation of being full. So we find that, especially in teenagers, for each hour of sleep that's lost or that they're deprived that night, that balance is altered and it results in increased hunger sensation and they tend to eat more and there tend to be an associated obesity with those children that are not getting their proper sleep.
This is fascinating in large respect because I think when we think about the obesity epidemic that's going on, we tend to think about fast foods, we tend to think about junk food, not enough exercise. But you're bringing to the table something about proper sleep.
It is fascinating. They're actually considering sleep deficits as a risk factor for diabetes, that we should be more attentive to sleep disturbances in children and to be more alert as far as identifying it as a potential risk factor for diabetes. And we are on a national scale seeing more newly diagnosed diabetics in the adolescent years. The key to wellness is good sleep, good effective sleep.
So many people take melatonin to go to sleep. Can we go so far, as best as we know, is it a melatonin deficiency of sorts? Why would they need extra melatonin to go to sleep? Do we have any sense?
We do. We know that melatonin is a precursor to sleep, and it's released upon darkness. Sleep hygiene counseling is to make sure that the bedroom is dark, that the windows have dark coverings, so there's no light coming in. Some patients require iPad to help them to initiate their sleep process. We do find is later in life, melatonin release becomes less.
Okay.
And it's interesting, they studied this effect in blind people because they don't have the light perception. They just have the dark perception. There's two systems for sleep. You have your innate neurotransmitter cycle for sleep, which is actually 25 hours.
Not 24 hours.
The 24 hours is in regard to the circadian rhythm. One's biochemical and the other's circadian, which is light and dark initiated. So when they study patients that were blind, it's difficult because they tried giving cyclic treatment with melatonin in the hopes of trying to get their cycle intact, but found that there could be an accumulation of melatonin, and that can also alter the sleep cycle as well. So it's being studied. It's one of the things that they're still looking into.
It generates so many questions about the very complex interplay between our environment and our internal chemistries, critical for our systems, namely sleep. Does sleep deprivation affect other things, for example, cognitive functions during the day, just being able to function, to drive? Does it affect driving?
Absolutely. Excessive sleepiness that's associated with sleep disorders, in extreme cases, because of drowsiness and loss of mental facilities, cognition, there's been things like the Exxon Valdez oil spill, the Three Mile Island and Chernobyl nuclear plant accidents. We see a lot of motor vehicle accidents in patients that are sleep deprived, shift workers that are driving home after work in the early morning hours. Those are the extremes. In the elderly, it results in falls, in accidents, because they're tired, their guard's down, and in the elderly, a hip fracture could be lethal. As far as cognitive skills, sleep deprivation, your focus is down, your reaction times are down. These are patients that have trouble making decisions. Problem-solving skills become difficult. Memory. At a time when you need good sleep, that's kind of like how the brain restores your learning. It puts what you learned that day into files. And with fragmented sleep or not enough sleep, you have a hard time remembering things. Recall, your emotions, your mood gets altered. You tend to make more mistakes.
I don't know when you went to medical school and residency, but when I did, we were sometimes up for 24 hours was considered a short day. And by the end of a day and a half, it was ridiculous. We couldn't think our way through things. And God only knows how many mistakes all of us made or things that we just missed. There has been a very strong movement not to let residents be on call for such long periods of time, which matches exactly what you're saying.
Yes, I had to pay my dues too. And it's extremely difficult. When you were able to sneak in a little nap during that night shift, you had to respond promptly with that phone call.
So you had to wake up whether you were in stage 1, 2, 3, or 4 or during a REM. It didn't matter.
It did not matter. And they expected you and you had to perform. You had to be there.
There are some medications on the market now that claim to be useful for shift work. They come to you and say, hey, doc, I got a job. I'm going to be making donuts all night long. How do you address with such a massive infusion of a reality? The person has to work. They have to get a paycheck, but their clocks are flipped.
More often than not, they don't present with that complaint. They'll come in with other issues. It could just be fatigue. I'm tired. Or mood alterations. So a lot of the symptoms that they experience could be confused for anxiety or even depression. But these patients are exhausted. They're tired. They're sleepy tired. So we screen for patients that work non-traditional hours, including the shift workers, medical personnel, law enforcement. Three things to identify shift work disorder is someone who works shift work or atypical hours, someone who's excessively sleepy or tired at a time that they're supposed to be awake. And in order for this to be considered a disorder, there has to be some dysfunction. And that dysfunction is if it alters your social life, your home life, your life with your family. These patients with shift work disorder, well, they take caffeine during their shift to help stay awake. When they get home, it's difficult for these patients to get their restorative sleep because the caffeine is still in their system. Oftentimes, they may be offered a sleeping medication to take when they get home. The shift workers, they may not experience it their first shift of the week, maybe not the second shift, but typically we see at the third or fourth shift that they have a hard time staying awake when they need to stay awake. And of course, that does result in errors and poor job performance. There are medications available that can help you stay awake at the time that you need to stay awake. Patients that use that prior to their shift are better able to get restorative sleep when they do get home.
That it just doesn't keep them up, but it allows them to, as much as possible, to get the restorative sleep. That's a key point.
Absolutely. And the key thing, too, is when they're driving home. We see time and time again, police officers, medical personnel, when they're driving home from their night shift, there's accidents. They're crashing into trees. We have to be more on guard and screen for shift work.
part of our society is dependent on having people up all night.
Yes. It's estimated that there's 15 million Americans that work night shift in non-traditional hours. Up to 25% of them fit the criteria for shift work disorder.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. The ones that don't really fit that criteria, up to 45% do report excessive sleepiness.
When a person is feeling some sort of fatigue, anxiety, or a discomfort, and they fall into one of the many patterns that we've talked about, they should come to their doctor and really talk about their sleep patterns as much as everything else, and then maybe there can be some appropriate intervention, a safety net for both the person themselves and the people around the person. Carl Sparaza is a family practitioner in Boca Raton, Florida. Thank you very much for being with us, and I know you had one more thing to say. Go ahead.
Case in point, a police officer, currently working, 55 years old, obese, pre-diabetic, hypertension. And we talked about shift work. And he's lucky enough that he paid his dues, and he's now back to his normal routine schedule. Then we talked about colleagues and especially the new recruit. And I asked him, I said, would it be helpful if we reached out to the shift workers, to your police officers that are doing the night shift, and gave a presentation on shift work disorder and all the implications, the precursors associated hypertension, diabetes, heart disease. And what he said was interesting. He said that he found that in the new recruits, and they start at the age of 21 hiring for his department, they feel invincible, that it's not going to happen to them. They don't have to worry about it. It's not on the radar. And here he is, age 55, many years later, wishing he had done things differently. Because there are things that we can help the shift workers minimize any disruptions to their circadian rhythm. I asked the same individual, when you were 21, and if we had this discussion on shift work, would it change your day-to-day? And he said, no. When I was 21, I was invincible, and I would have not taken any of this into consideration.
So many of the things that you actually pointed out today are really critical elements to our overall health, and they all connect to sleep. I thank you very much, and what a great story to end with. I hope that people listen to it and learn from it. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah.